I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. It seems like beer enthusiasts, myself included, are always looking forward. When we're not trying to figure out what the next IPA is going to be, it's easy to prognosticate about upcoming business plans, releases, and who needs to learn more about whoever the next hot brewery may be. But as we've heard so many times before, you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. Liz Garibay is the person you may want to call when it's time to bridge these things as both historian and beer lover. For years, she's led a project known as History on Tap, which traces history through alcohol, and for herself and others, created inspiration to better understand how beer and its unique community factor into larger cultural stories. As founder and director of the Chicago Brewzam, she's also had an analytical view toward the history of drinking in one of America's most iconic cities. I ran into Liz this summer at the annual Beer Bloggers and Writers Conference, where she told me about a new exhibition she was a part of, and as our conversation drifted over all sorts of beer topics, I wanted to take the chance to sit down with Liz for the podcast as a way to better capture some of the ideas of how drinking past has an ability to shape our drinking future. There's no need to break out your Encyclopedia Britannica for this one, but I do hope you'll enjoy some of the extra context all us beer lovers might miss when we're keeping our heads on a swivel, just trying to keep up with everything that's certain to be next. This is historian Liz Garibay. Listen in. Thank you very much for joining.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me.
I think what excites me about learning from you and your perspective is certainly something that we have talked about before in terms of kind of the historical context and what that means and what that is in terms of beer. A lot of people who think about beer way too much, probably both of us included, obviously, there's a certain just routine of thinking very much in the modern, but a lot of what we go through and we experience now as beer drinkers is built on obviously things that have happened so long before, which leads into like a perfect 50,000 foot view question. Why is history important in beer?
Because it's always been there. It's definitely been an industry that has been a catalyst for civilization, for being sedentary, and for growing. And that's certainly why I came at what I do for that reason alone. It wasn't so much about I want to study the history of beer, because I actually don't consider myself a beer historian, because I can't tell you the nuances of, you know, XYZ decade or century or, you know, whatever part in the world. What I really try to focus on is looking at how beer played a role in building a certain city or a certain environment or a certain part of the world. And the reason I did that was because studying history, you look at various factors, right? And so, of course, industry and economy is a big one. And beer has just always sort of reared its pretty little head wherever you go. And so it's just an easy parallel, easy in my mind. You know, it's a very complicated subject, but beer is just a great way to talk about history.
What is the difference between an historian, a beer historian, or just someone who's interested in beer history?
Well, I think that, you know, if you say to someone you're a beer historian, they immediately, well, they do this with all history, they immediately start testing you, right? They start asking you all these questions. But if you say you're a beer historian, they'll be like, can you tell me more about this one story that they remember, right? Or one event that they, I don't know, somebody told them, blah, 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 blah. And so they expect you to sort of know that whole timeline in full detail. And while I can, you know, sort of give you the abbreviated version, I certainly don't claim to know every little, you know, detail about beer and how it's evolved. And I always say, I don't make beer. It just confuses me, even though I know the basic process. I have such respect for beer makers, just because of what they do. So, you know, and then they expect you to know all this stuff about the beer making too. So I think that's one side of it. Whereas if you're a historian, it's more like, well, people still expect you to know everything.
Why do you think there's that trivia quiz aspect of it?
Almost because I feel like it's this weird thing. It's almost like, why would you go that route? Why don't you just decide to, you know, be in finance? Or why wouldn't you just...
You care enough about this thing, so why aren't you doing it now? Is that kind
of
what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think it's sort of like this, there's this kind of like cool factor to it, but at the same time, it's sort of like this confusion behind it, and people will always try to make a personal connection no matter what, no matter what you're talking about, right? So with history, I think they immediately start going to an aspect of history that they might know about, and then the quiz starts right away, but I don't mind it because I think you can naturally just sort of grow that into a very organic conversation, and that's really what I love.
How do you make that pivot?
You always, basically say, oh, uh-huh, you listen, and you acknowledge their knowledge, and then I usually sort of infuse another aspect of it, and then we kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm.
People are great. I mean, these are great conversations to have with folks, and I just think that the history part of it is sort of, you always get the same sort of reaction, like, oh,
Well, it's I think it speaks to the unique pop culture connection to it. And this maybe isn't unique to beer, but just aspects of history as a whole. These are things that we don't think about on a day-to-day basis. So I guess I'm not terribly surprised that a first reaction would be, oh, well, you think you know everything, so let me see what you do actually know.
Right.
And then to try to, I guess, feel it out in terms of how deep that expertise actually goes.
Yeah, and you know, I'll right away say this is what I focus on. You know, you want to talk military history? No, that's not my game. Mm-hmm. But you know, I can talk about 19th century United States or Revolutionary era, you know, drinking culture, or you know, I'll sort of say this is what I focus on, like, you know, all fields. So people will then embrace that, and still want to make a personal connection, which is, I think, is really important. So that just leads to more conversation, which again, I love.
If to do that, how do you try to audibly build that connection between somebody who has curiosity and this kind of ethereal thing in the past of which they have no direct connection? What's the actual like strategy that you use in the way that you're telling people these things to try to bridge that gap?
You know, it's really just about listening. You know, I just have to listen to what they say, and really everyone will have a story to tell. Or, you know, with alcohol history, with beer history, or one of the immediate things I always get to is, I think my grandfather owned a tavern, you know, in this corner of the world, or some aspect of that. Or my you know, great-grandfather worked in a brewery, or, you know, my great-grandmother was originally from Austria, or they'll try to make that connection to beer and to the past, which is valid and is thoughtful, and which is inspiring and adds to my knowledge too, which is what I really love. So I'll just listen to their story and, you know, try to, I don't know, add to it or make connections if I can. And again, that just kind of leads us down this really cool path where we're just having a conversation over a beer.
Mm. And so the overarching value of history is there. But from your perspective, what is the answer to that question for you? Why is it that you care so much about these things?
I honestly believe that, two things. I think it really is sort of part of my identity. A big part of it, I think, came from, I started in ancient history, more archaeology, Mesoamerican archaeology, and that was definitely infused in me as a kid. My parents are from Mexico City. And they would make every effort to take our family vacations. Well, everyone was going to Wisconsin Dells, you know, or some beach on some coast. My family, you know, was going down to Mexico to visit family that they hadn't seen in a while. And often I would get bored, and my mom would encourage me to, you know, the family to go to some ruins or something. And I think that immediately instilled a sense of curiosity from my past because it had connections to my own identity.
Or things that you didn't know or didn't understand at the time but wanted to better know about in order to make those connections.
Correct. Yeah. Like, where did we come from, mm-hmm. right? And it definitely shaped me as a human and as a thinker. And it certainly shaped my career. You know, my, like I said, my degrees and my background was all in that field. But it also, archaeology, I learned that it can be very, a little too academic for me in the environment. And also it can be very lonely when you're out there for, you know, 3 or 4 months at a time in the middle of nowhere. So I shifted gears into more urban history. And I think that happened, again, because of my identity, but mostly my identity as being a Chicagoan. Mm-hmm. So I have a big, big, deep passion for Chicago and just really kind of wanted to learn more about how that city came to be. And so doing a lot of work and research and just being there, really, from growing up in Chicago, that kind of all shaped it all. So it was this really odd sort of evolution of who I was and who I am and sort of where I'm going that kind of led me down this road of looking more at urban history. And, you know, I like to drink, so beer
makes
helps.
It an easy connection.
And yeah, and, you know, being from Chicago and again the Midwest has such a great beer history. Really, I kind of call it the Fertile Crescent of the West because of the agriculture and the beer industry that made it really grow in during the 19th century. So I think it really, interestingly, has a lot to do with just who I am and where I'm from.
Do you remember what the catalyst was for that? When you were experiencing this growing interest in history, but then realized that urban history and even more so Chicago history was something that really kind of piqued your interest. Was there a particular instance or example or something that really just made things click that put you down this path?
You know what it was? It was really just sitting in old man bars. That's kind of my preferred bar. You know, I don't like to say a dive bar because dive bars have this, like, I feel like they have this weird, almost like we're better than that place, because they're cheap, you know, cheaper beverages, sort of like, you know, just ordinary people. I don't like that label for that reason, right? Because I think we're all sort of on the same playing field once we walk through those doors of that bar. So I like to call more that sort of neighborhood bar the old man bar, where you have old men around drinking probably a lot of macro beer and specials and shot in a beer and blah, blah, blah. So that's the kind of place I like to go drink.
I suppose old style would be the
in
right
Chicago,
choice
right.
there.
Yeah. Old style and Malort. Chicago handshake. So getting to know a lot of these older people who had been drinking at these bars, you know, all they do all day long, or for at least part of the day, is drink and talk with one another, and they go down memory lane constantly. So I would have this education that I never got anywhere else by just listening to them talk, and I was just really intrigued by these stories and fascinated, and at the same time thinking, you know, they've been around, they know this stuff, but they've also been drinking, so how much of this is true, right? Fact versus fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of like this oral history, which I think can be very valid, combined with real research that you do in a museum or a library, really kind of helps when you mesh the two together, gives you really very, very real, true history of a place. And so I started just doing a lot of these individual tavern histories of bars that I used to like to go to. And next thing I knew, you could connect the dots to a lot of these bars in the same area, and then you'd have the history of a neighborhood. And then you connect the dots further, and you have the history of a city. So it was really kind of just, you know, my passion for sitting and listening to a lot of, you know, folks older than me who had been drinking and learning from them. And I think that was truly the catalyst for it all.
What do you remember some of those things that you learned from the old men drinking at the old man bar?
You know what it was? Like, for example, like one of the very first bars I ever went to, well, as a legal human, right? was a bar in the neighborhood where I grew up in. And the only reason I wanted to start going there.
What neighborhood was that?
It's called Old Town in Chicago. And the bar is called the Old Town Ale House. And the only reason I wanted to go there was because I used to walk by it so much when I was a kid. And it just always, you know, there's that weird, like, you may not enter, right?
Yeah.
So when I was able finally to enter, I certainly entered with grand fervor. And I was curious by the place because it literally is a place that was founded in 1958 and it feels like you're walking into the 1960s. And I really sort of loved that environment. And then I, you know, went off to different parts of the world for school and to work. And when I started, when I came back to Chicago, I started going there and I started becoming a regular. And I had already started a lot of my research, but I had gone there before to sort of get those stories. But going there as a regular, you start, I don't know, it's a very different experience, right, when you're a regular at a certain space. So it was really about drinking there and then drinking in other establishments in the neighborhood and then drinking in other establishments just where I would call home for wherever it was. I spent a lot of time in Boston as well. And drinking in some of these old man bars in Boston, what you realize is we're not all that different. You know, no matter where you are, a lot of these stories are very similar. People have very similar experiences, no matter what decade you're talking about, you know. So time and space, sure, they matter. But in the long run, it's really kind of all the same.
So the difference there, experiencing these things in Chicago and Boston, like you were saying, the conversations are very similar and the experiences of these people in these bars certainly draw parallels. One of the, I think, the beauties or ugliness, depending on your perspective of when we talk about dive bars or old man bars, is it immediately conjures up a consistency that there that space, that physical space, and then your experience therein is going to be consistent no matter where you are.
For sure.
You know, you're in this, whether it's a small little town or a big city, you go to a dive bar, it's going to be what you kind of expect and what you build in your mind. But you're talking about variables now,
right?
You started to find things that, despite all these commonalities of the stories that might have been told there, there were still little different things that helped you go a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no matter where you go, people are going to have different stories, different experiences. So, you know, at the Old Town Ale House, the owner Bruce, you know, he's this magical storyteller, and he'll tell me stories about, you know, bars that are gone that I could never experience because they've been gone for years. But he'll tell me stories about the place and the people or the people who were regulars before me. And, you know, all of these things just start to sort of connect in a really unique kind of way. So for me, it's really kind of like a learning experience to sit there and chat with these folks who have been drinking for far longer than I have. But it really kind of gives you so much perspective on how much the past affects the present.
Hmm. Was any of that perspective different? Chicago versus Boston versus anywhere else you've been? Did you notice something different in terms of maybe not the physical space or the stories given the time frame in which they could happen, but other things about the way that people told their stories or the way that people gathered or just what was going on or being served at these locations? Was there anything different that made them unique?
Aside from sort of local cultural differences,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Outside of accents, I suppose.
Right, you know, or like you know, people in Boston won't know what a Chicago handshake is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But or Old Style, for that matter. People in Chicago won't know what a Cape Codder is, right?
What is a Cape Codder?
It's just vodka with cranberry juice and like a slice of lemon.
I understand now.
Yeah. but that's what it is, right? So it's like these little nuances that are just very local.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's the biggest difference. But really, like a lot of these stories are not, you know, not that different.
What are the most common denominator aspects of these stories that you were hearing?
Love, hate, you know, happiness, sadness, really everything that just encompasses change, for sure.
It's Hollywood reflections, almost, is what
yeah,
it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the reason we go to bars, right?
Hmm.
You could pick, again, any time period, any place, and everyone is sitting in that bar for the exact same reason. Because they want to drink, they want to be with people that hopefully are like them. They want to either just relax, or they want to celebrate, or they want to be sad. It's sort of those characteristics, those reasons why we've always, as humans, have gone into drinking establishments. And for that matter, you know, you always know, like you said, what you're going to get, right? Old man bar, you know what you're going to get, right? But at the same time, you know, if you're going to a sports bar, expect all those TVs everywhere, but you're going there probably maybe because you want to see some sort of game.
And it's not the same kind of interaction either with the humans or the space.
Correct, right? So again, as long as humans have been alive, for the most part, there's always been sort of an environment, a drinking environment for your sort of purpose, for your desires, because you want to be with like people. During the 19th century, we had these things called ethnic bars, right? Where you knew that you could be with someone who looked like you, dressed like you, spoke like you, had newspapers in your language, food, you know, certain beverages, and that was really important for that reason. So we've always gravitated to these places where people are going to be like us. And whether you're talking about, you know, 500 AD or, you know, 1820 or 2018, it's always been the same.
In regard to that, the unique quirkiness or just the unique aspect of the 19th century drinking culture, so something like the ethnic bars.
Right.
How was it that those came about and especially gained kind of that prominent status of an integral part of the drinking culture?
I would not say that they were prominent or looked at in a very positive way by sort of the majority culture in America. You know, this is the height of immigrants coming to our country. And right when they came, there was already some animosity, already some sort of like hatred, strange outsiders. And so a lot of those immigrant groups kind of created their own spaces naturally. So it was just sort of a part of who we were.
It was a drinking culture built by necessity.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, it's also, you know, saloons and bars were always places originally where you would not just gather with, like, people, but you would share information or do similar things. You know, in any town, USA, you always had, I think, like a school, a church, and a bar. Right? But if the bar was usually always built first, and while the church was being built, you had church in the bar, you know? And so these are just important spaces because you're going to do things and be with people like you, but you always want to have a drink here and there. And so in 19th century America, for sure, that was certainly what was happening. And you know, there are also these places, we're so spoiled in this technological world that we live in, right? We have information on the ready, and if we don't have it immediately, we get ticked off that, you know, our phones aren't working or something. Whereas, you know, if you look at the mid-1800s, these people didn't have that access. So newspapers were the way they got information or talking amongst one another. So, you know, if you had these spaces that had both opportunities, this is where you could get information. So I like to call 19th century saloons the original Facebook, right? Where you sort of gossiped, or if you needed a recommendation, or if you needed any sort of, hey, my cousin is coming to the United States next month, and does anyone have any leads on any jobs, right? So it's all about networking. So yeah, these spaces were really just integral to the growth of these minority groups, which would eventually not be minority groups, but we kind of, again, follow all the same path.
Church, school, bar. And I think that maybe you're hinting at it here a little bit and maybe saying explicitly, why was that bar culture? Why was it that what it brought to those neighborhoods, those little pieces of society, so important at that point in time?
I think it's the same thing that we all crave today, and that's community. I think people just really want to be with one another and an environment that has drinking or eating, and usually they had both, right? Just creates a much more, you know, communal environment. Everyone wants to sort of partake and sit, and, you know, obviously there's nothing more sacred than what we're doing right now, right? Is having a conversation and having a couple of beers in front of us and digging deeper into something. And that, I think, has always been important for humans, for humanity. And I think that's one of the reasons why just bars were such an important and effective place for early America, for sure.
GBH is underwritten in part by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. With New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and Sour Ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in those early foundational chapters. These are stories about how those beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with on a new series called Mother of Invention. Stories devoted to illuminating innovation in the brewing world that impacts the beer in your hand in unexpected ways. Guinness just officially opened their first purpose-built brewery in the U.S. just outside of Baltimore, Maryland, where they have a 2- and 10-barrel brewing system that makes a wide spectrum of contemporary styles, served in the taproom only, and a 100-hectoliter system where they're scaling up some of their latest recipes for national distribution in the U.S., like the recently reinvented Blonde Ale and an American-style IPA. You should definitely visit, have a seat in their epic beer garden, and tour the historic distillery site, the first legal distillery after Prohibition in Maryland, right off historic Route 1. And of course, we're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pier Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The 5 Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, Verdant Brewing Company, and Boundary Brewing in Belfast. In the US, we have the Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Common House Ale Works in South Carolina, Yocusta Brewing in North Carolina, National Craft Retailer, Craft Beer Cellar, and Daredevil Brewing in Indianapolis. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, and Stone and Wood Brewing Company along the far eastern shore of Australia, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew.
When you look at that time frame and these themes in terms of Chicago in 19th century, what were some of the things that were going on during this period that you feel helped to kind of define what it meant to be drinking and interacting in a social atmosphere then?
One of the really interesting things that people I don't think about is that, well, in Chicago, in the Midwest, you know, during the early 1800s, we're really kind of, it's nothing. It's not a wasteland. It's prairie. You know, Chicago is a swamp. Certainly a thriving Native American culture. But literally, it is just open land. And so the first few immigrants that start coming in the 1820s, 1830s, Germans and later Irish, you know, these are people who are, in a sense, growing up with their city and truly building their city. So they're really kind of having to think about what's next, right? How are they going to grow it? And I think that's a really interesting aspect to look at a city's history, especially Chicago. And then, you know, it's growing. Other immigrants aren't coming. But everybody always thinks that they kind of just showed up and it was cool, right? Mm-hmm. There are already people here who were descendants of the Patriots from the 18th century. And they were already developing political parties where they were not so happy about the immigrant community that was coming. Didn't like them. They thought they were outsiders. They were odd. They were dangerous. Really kind of, again, I say history repeats itself, and it's true. Everything that's going on right now happened in the 19th century in our country. So it was not an easy road for them by any means, but it was certainly a journey that they had to take and that they certainly embraced because they had to, right, out of necessity. And eventually they were considered just important components of the community and necessary, right, because they were actually contributing to the greater good. So I think that a lot of times from a historic perspective, an American historic perspective, we think that the early immigrants who came here were just immediately sort of embraced and, you know, integrated easily, but their paths were incredibly difficult, and so they certainly had to work at being just sort of appreciated, for sure.
Walk me through the timeline a little bit in regard to these kind of societal challenges as it relates to some of the drinking culture during this time, mm-hmm. in Chicago, obviously. What were some of the things that were happening during this period to kind of go along these kinds of steps from the point of animosity toward acceptance?
So Chicago officially becomes a settlement in the late 1600s. French Canadian fur traders arriving, integrating with Native American groups. But we don't really see any sort of outsider presence until the late 1700s, early 1800s, when the U.S. military establishes a fort called Fort Dearborn, which is right in the heart of the city, was in the heart of the city today. And then you start getting some of these German immigrants in the 1820s, that German immigrant sort of arrival. Chicago becomes an official city in 1837, right? In 1833, we become an official township. So originally, we're the village of Chicago. And then in 1833, we are a township. 1837, we are a city. In 1833, the sort of civic leaders at that time decided that they needed to think about the future of this small village. So they say, hey, let's go have a conversation. And so some smart chap in the mix says, great, let's go to the bar. So they go to the hottest bar in town called the Saugnash Tavern, which is located in the Saugnash Hotel. This is the kind of place where you'd want a good fiddle off, a good,
Sorry, a what?
A fiddle off.
And what is that?
You know,
that's not a violin, like, dueling.
Oh, yeah.
That is what, that is, oh, it is. That's exactly what it is.
Exactly what it is. A fiddle off.
Did not expect to nail that.
You did. You know, get some good whiskey, get some good ales, just some good dancing. Maybe a good gambling game, right? And so they say, hey, let's go throw some back and make a decision about the future of this village. And they drink and they talk and they vote. Should Chicago, the village, become a township? And the majority said yes. They go back to that same spot 4 years later to the Saugnash Tavern and say, should this township become a city?
This is the 1837.
Yes. So majority says yes. So the beginnings of our city are literally in the bowels of a bar, not once, but twice. 1833 is the exact same year that our very first brewery gets established, right? So there's already, and those, that is established by these German immigrants who come to Chicago via New York, Haas and Sulzer. And so immediately from the beginnings of Chicago as a new township and a new city, you have that German presence. And then you have, of course, that beer industry because those Germans are bringing their skill sets. And so beer is there from the very beginning. But again, as we start evolving into the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, you know, these views are changing about the masses of Germans and Irish coming through now. And now, again, they're considered sort of to be a little bit overwhelming. And this is the same time that, again, these political parties are starting to grow, these anti-immigrant political parties. Same time the temperance movement starts in 1833 as well, right? So you have these two groups who are trying to fight these people who are drinking, right? And they actually have a very common denominator in that these Germans are drinkers. So they unite forces and they go after a lot of these immigrant groups, and they go after the fact that they are drinking on Sundays, their only days off, and that they are involved in the alcohol industry. And so this is when tensions start to rise amongst these different groups, and it causes Chicago's first moment of civil unrest is called the 1855 Lager Beer Riot, where our mayor tries to change a couple laws. One, that Sundays are going to be illegal for anybody to drink, so bars have to be closed. And two, he raises liquor license fees from $50 per year to $300 per quarter. Unaffordable. So it's really rooted and targeted towards these groups. And so these are also people who are already trying to establish themselves, right? They have established themselves. They're just trying to live their lives. And now they're being targeted. And so they fight back, rightfully so. And so this is the beginning of some major tension that exists well into the 1880s. And I don't think it actually just stops. What happens is Chicago suffers a fire in 1871. It's sort of like all hands on deck. Screw what we were talking about before, because we got to get in on this together and rebuild the city. And then into the 1890s, where we have our moment of sort of what I call glory with the 1893 World's Fair. And everyone is just sort of like, hey, we did this together, these Germans, these Irish, whatever, they were a little bit different, but now they're just integral parts of society, and then we kind of move from there. So it's not just it's not a one-way simple road that a lot of these immigrant groups sort of went down. It was certainly a very difficult path that they experienced, and I think one that a lot of you know, modern era immigrant groups are experiencing as well.
Throughout the kind of the complicated history and the connections that from 1833 onward that set on this kind of odd collision course of all these variable, these all the different parties. What are some of the things that come out of that? When you think about that time period and the way things over that 60-year period essentially evolved and changed and grew, what are some of the things that you think about that have to that continue to have connections today?
Boy, you know, there's so many of them. I can't even begin to think to pinpoint one. Again, that immigrant story has always been so essential to our, not just to Chicago, but to our whole country. And it really is sort of this thing where, if you think about it, there's always going to be someone in the background, you know, that wants to be the hater. And I think you can make so many parallels to what happened back then to what's happening now, right? So immigration is one thing. In the beer industry, you know, we always have kind of this fight between, you know, craft beer and macro beer. And, you know, a lot of these breweries that are now macro, this is when they get their beginnings, right? And so they're just trying to do the exact same thing. Of course, time changes a lot of that, and things evolve in different ways, and business practices change, and, you know, goals are different and plans are different. But this is the beginning of our entire American beer industry. So it's hard for me to sometimes separate the two, in a sense. So there's a lot of connections there. There's a lot of connections between the beginnings of all of our cities, especially in the Midwest, right? In forming our identity and our culture, right? Chicago, Midwest, you go to Chicago, you go to Milwaukee, any part of Wisconsin, any part of, you know, Northeast Missouri, or even places in Iowa or in Indiana, we are a blue-collar, immigrant, meat-and-potatoes kind of place, right? Very simple. What you see is what you get. And I think all of that is very much rooted in the people who establish our cities. So everywhere I look, I know I'm a little jaded, but everywhere I look, I always see hints of, you know, the 1800s.
And well, in some of those cities, I mean, Chicago, Milwaukee, especially, people, I think it's easy to think about those in terms of being beer cities.
Yeah.
By virtue of the immigrants that came over and established themselves and built these companies that you're talking about, it creates a strange dichotomy where it sounds like, you know, the way that we think about a lot of the macro beer companies today, where in some eyes creating the division that may exist within the industry at that time, sounds like may have been and played an important role in terms of bringing people together to create what is now the history of these cities as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these breweries that grew, you know, they were innovators. You know, they were their businesses provided jobs for all of these young cities that were just, you know, trying to get off the ground in a sense, and help them eventually just grow into these metropolises that we now know. They were incorporating science, new technologies. They were just really essential parts of the fabric of every single city you can imagine, and were such big contributors. And so, you know, to talk about sort of the history of the United States or the history of any region USA without talking about beer, you know, is sort of would make zero sense to me.
Mm-hmm. So why is it important then to try to keep that aspect of history in mind? When we talk about these, when we talk about history, especially in relation perhaps to urban history, in which a lot of the connective tissue to beer certainly has existed, why is it so important to keep that kind of thing in mind rather than just the acts that brought, you know, urban civilization to where we are now versus thinking about some of these tangential variables, beer being one of them, that helped guide it?
Yeah. I don't know about you, But, and I'm sure you get this all the time, but when you tell people that you work in some aspect of beer, I'm sure people are always like, oh, so you're always drinking, right?
Very true.
It's always like, oh, so you're always drinking.
It's like the joke with brewers. It's like, oh, it must be great. You just hang out and drink beer all day.
Yeah.
Well, not really.
Don't think there's any work involved. And so I mention that because I feel that we need to keep reminding people that beer is more than just a beverage, right? Beer actually made our country what it is. It was sort of embedded in some of these young people who came here during the 1800s and wanted to, you know, sort of live out this American dream. It still is today. It's just a very, very powerful cultural force, an economic force throughout our entire history. And I think that we don't talk about that enough. You know, we need to remind people that, honestly, you know, we wouldn't be here without beer. And it's not just about getting drunk. It's not just about enjoying a good beverage. It really kind of is integrated into every aspect of who we are as a country, as a nation, as a world. And I think that for me is what sort of drives me every day, is to say, look, you know what? Yeah, you know that event, or you know that person you always talk about? Let me tell you how beer played a role in that, or how alcohol played a role in that. And that kind of is what sort of keeps me going.
So how do you try to tell that story without giving the impression or feeding into that stereotypical thought that, oh, it's just, you're just sitting around drinking beer, to try to emphasize that it does have these serious connections?
You just start talking, I think. I love doing research, and I love learning. And so if I find out about a person or an event or just something that intrigues me, and I kind of, you know, go down that path, then it naturally often leads me down a few different rabbit holes. And to me, that's exciting. And so if I can be the person to go sort of excavate those things and bring them to life and then start sharing them with people, I like to infuse that excitement into people, and then I like to see their reaction and then have that little moment where they're like, oh my gosh, I never knew that, right? And so that, I think, just creates this really powerful sort of bandwidth of knowledge, and elevates sort of the beer game in a different way, right? If we can talk about this stuff, how it relates to the past, how it mattered for this person or this event, and how it can relate to us right now while we're drinking it, I think that's pretty special. And I just think that having that knowledge, right? Knowledge is power. I think that is what really kind of matters in it all.
What would you say is one of the more important things that you've learned recently to help you do that?
Oh, boy. That's a really hard question, Brian. You know, I try to do research at least. I try to focus on going and doing research at least 2 whole days out of the month. One, because I feel like I can't say I'm this historian if I'm not actually out there doing the research. 2, that's the part that I like, right? It excites me. So every single time I go and I'm looking at stuff, I get so excited about new things that I learn, new things that I see. Gosh, one of the coolest things I just experienced last month was I went to visit the archivist and the executive director at the Pabst Mansion in Milwaukee. And we were talking about the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago, where there was this big battle between Anheuser-Busch and Pabst, right? And
if I remember correctly, this is the Blue Ribbon event.
Which is a myth.
Yeah.
They did not win the Blue Ribbon. Pabst did not win the Blue Ribbon at the World's Fair, but they did win the whole shebang. So one of the things that fascinated me when talking to them is that we have all these beautiful old images of the World's Fair. They're all black and white because that was the technology, right? And so we, as, you know, people living in 2018, have no idea what it was to actually experience that fair in its full form, right? In full color. So the archivist just looked at me and she's like, I'm about to blow your mind. And I said, okay. So she pulls out this big folder, and they inherited a lot of the Schlitz Brewing archives. And of course, these big breweries are going to build these big pavilions, right? It's a big trade show. People are coming to drink beer. I always like to call it sort of like one of the first beer fests. And because they had to build them, they needed architects to sketch everything out, and they needed illustrators and all this stuff. So she pulls out this folder, and I've seen lots of pictures of the Schlitz Pavilion at the 1893 World's Fair, but these are all the color renderings. And no one had ever seen them before. They had just found them. They had inherited them from Schlitz. And so that just gave me an idea of what it was like to walk through that agricultural building at the 1893 World's Fair and see it in full glory. And it was just such a powerful experience to just see that for the first time. And so when I walked away from that, I was just like, God, it was amazing, amazing.
But who won the blue ribbon?
So, not Schlitz. So Pabst won the whole thing. It was a very controversial situation. But there was no blue ribbon. Pabst, I think it was in 1884, he was a great marketer, as many of these first, big brewers, these beer barons were. And he wanted to sort of tell people, hey, look, I've got this really good product. But he knew he had to sort of sell it. So he started packaging his beer in bottles like everyone else did, but he wanted to make it look extra fancy. So he started putting these really beautiful light blue silk ribbons around the bottle, because then you would know that, this beautiful product probably had, a beautiful bottle had beautiful product in it, and then you would buy it. And so his sales went up, and he always had blue ribbon. And so when, they didn't get blue ribbons, by the way, anyone who entered that competition got the same damn gold medal. That was it. Right? No,
really?
Matter. No, yeah, it was just like an entry. Thanks for entering.
It was a millennial trophy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So when Pabst won the competition, they changed their name. It was Pabst Select. Pabst Best Select Beer is what they entered. And then when he won the competition, they changed it to Pabst Blue Ribbon as one as the 1893 World's Fair or something like that. He incorporated the blue ribbon that from the past into that victory, and then history got all messed up, and everyone believes that
the past impacting today.
Yeah.
That's how it's supposed to work.
That's right. That's right.
Interesting. A wonderful story. A really great example, I think, of that connective tissue to show how things have that kind of through line to the way that things exist today as well.
Yeah, for sure. It is that whole fair thing is an amazing story, but that's just one of thousands that are out there, which is why I kind of keep going at it.
Well, I look forward to more that you uncover along the way.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This is GBH's founder, Michael Kaiser. If you find value in the content that GBH produces, we'd love to hear it. Rate the podcast, tweet at us, send us an email, share it with a friend, whatever makes sense for you. That feedback goes a long way and helps others find us too. And if you're feeling generous, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion, and you should join. If you'd like to support GBH, visit goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.